Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to part two in this mini-series on surviving spiritual abuse on the Cult Vault podcast. I'm your speaker, Casey, and in part one, I spoke with Ken Garrett about the general signs of toxic religious spaces. In part two, Ken talks about his personal experience in an abusive church. And in part three, we discuss his family, their escape, Ken's recovery, activism, and holding on to his faith. If you would like to support the podcast, please consider heading over to patreon.com/thecultvault for early access to ad-free and full-length episodes from only £1 a month or $1.50. And now, here is Ken. So, the second half of our conversation is really going to focus on the subject of religious trauma and spiritual abuse and how an individual may be able to come out of an abusive environment like this one and still be able to their faith. And I suppose a good way to start with that would be to ask if you could give us a synopsis of the book Wounded Faith.
Oh, yes. Well, Wounded Faith, great book. It's a book that is a compilation of chapters written by speakers and teachers that are a part of the International Cultic Studies Association, who mostly have experienced spiritual abuse in Christian settings, as I have. And so with a consistent, with a growing phenomena of abuse survivors from Christian churches, the ICSA, International Cultic Studies Association, they put some resources into, okay, how do we take care of these particular people? Because there's some distinctions or distinctives about a Christian abuse survivor that are often different than other forms of abuse from, say, Eastern religions or commercial cults, military, whatever. So there's some distinct things that we need to remember about these survivors. And so this book is an attempt to kind of specifically put the medicine right on the wound of abuse experienced in Christianity.
In the House of Friends, Understanding and Healing from Spiritual Abuse in Christian Churches, the official title of your full published book, is that right?
Yes.
And the contributing chapter that you have in Wounded is a chapter from the book In the House of Friends.
Yes, yes. I have two chapters in Wounded Faith. The one on what the walking wounded experience as they go to church. And I think that's probably the most helpful. The other one has kind of become like the Beatles' Butcher Block album cover. I mean, it is lost, and it's in the very, very back of the book, because I had this great idea of wanting to present an exegetical consideration of Psalm 139 or 37. And I think my chapter is about as boring as it sounds in its title, because nobody said a thing about that one. But yeah, that's my chapter, my contribution to Wounded Faith.
The chapter that I read, it stood out to me for a number of reasons. And I think I mentioned in an email to you that there was thought around in my mind that I couldn't quite put into words. I couldn't summarize it in a way that was neat and tidy that would make sense to people. And all of my listeners will know what I'm about to say. It happens to me all the time. I'm not concise with my words, and I go around and around in circles trying to say what it is that I mean. And you did that so in this chapter. So I wanted to go through some of the subheadings that you had within this chapter, where you gave explanations to what an individual might experience in terms of religious abuse, and why the things that we are doing help, or why they won't help, or why they can't help. I've written some notes here and I'm not in them. I wondered if we could take a brief look at each of these subheadings, and if you might be able to explain to the listeners how some of these things may manifest within abusive spiritual environments. And the first one that I've got written here is economic wounds.
Yeah, economic wounds. First off, unless you're in a name it and claim it kind of, you know, go grab money for Jesus kind of a church, which most of them are not, you have been in a place where your economic welfare has been pretty much diminished and not even with no concern. The only value of your money has been what you can give to your abuser. So along the way, the longer that you're in this kind of a traumatic, cultic type situation, the more money you give and do not use and invest for things that would bring you joy, bless your life, be a, you know, enjoy that Italian restaurant that is your favorite. I mean, the little things and the big things of investments and growth for the future and retirement and, you know, just the things we do with our money, which represents the hours of our life. So when you're a part of this group and it comes time that you've left, the contract's been broken, you're out the door, you often can find yourself having very diminished economic resources. And Sharon and I had no credit. We had, besides not having credit, we had a terrible credit score. We couldn't get credit. And because we burned through credit cards and everything to pay money into the church. So economically, in terms of the real value, we were pretty low in what we had. And then also, this deals with economics. We had not, while we were in the cult, I had not taken advantage of situations that would increase my economic holdings, like furthering my education, getting a better job, moving up in leadership and management in as a paramedic to make more money, to increase the stature and the material goods of my family. And of course, money isn't everything, and I understand that. But nonetheless, those dollars represent the hours of my life, and that does mean a lot. And the cult takes that from you and leaves you economically disadvantaged often. It's very, very common for survivors of these kinds of groups, and including people that grow up in these kinds of groups, to have much material resources and earning power. So if they do, but oftentimes it's been diminished.
I suppose in regards to economic wounds, if we're looking at the state of the world and the cost of living crisis that we're experiencing between the pandemic and everything that's happening with Russia and the Ukraine, there's an element to that of financial security, being able to pay those rising bills, being able to offer comfort in an economic crisis to your family, whether that's heating the house or cooling the house down when, you know, the summers are far, far too hot, or just being able to keep a roof over your family's head, the, you know, enough food and provisions to keep everybody comfortable. Yes. Without the cost of living crisis, that's something that often comes up in these interviews as well. once said to me that they had to get all their ducks in a row before they left the Jehovah's Witnesses. And one of those ducks, of course, included having enough money to survive leaving because of the shunning process, which we know is particularly brutal for people that are born and raised in groups and have no idea how they're going to live. And the next subheading that I've got written here, which you did touch on briefly in that last section, is educational and professional wounds.
Yeah. Oftentimes in these groups, there might be an ideological aversion toward higher education. Oftentimes the pastors and the leaders of them have not been formally educated. They have studied on their own or studied perhaps through a non-accredited organization. Our pastor started to go to school and dropped out, I think because he felt he was too smart to need a higher education for this, and he was smarter than everybody, and that's just my opinion on it. Oftentimes these groups are led by people whose education was either defective or non-existent. So there's not a value on continuing education. There's also often not a value on education for children, particularly women. Why would you need to get a master's degree? What you really need to do is be a good wife and mother. That's the whole, you know, that's God's plan for your life. Of course, that's disastrous, and it's a terrible way to treat a human being. But those kinds of ideas get thrown out as truth, which dissuade the cult member from continuing on. I wanted to go to seminary when I joined the cult, and I shared that with one of the pastors, and he said, well, that's interesting. And the next couple of days we got together, and he said, you know, I've been thinking about it. I talked to the pastor, Mike, and which gave some added authority to talk to the senior pastor about little old me, right? And he said, we just decided seminary would be the worst thing for you. It would just kill your faith, make you a religious phony, and we can do better. We can educate you better. And I believed it. And so I didn't go to seminary for many years. And that was a diminishment of an educational opportunity. And had it been seminary or medical school, which was another thing I'd been considering, regardless of the particular field of study, the church frowned on that. They wanted my money and my brain power and everything to contribute to their immediate success in their little house out in Southeast Portland, rather than taking me away to university or libraries and things like that. So that's kind of, you know, how that worked. And then when you walk away from such a church, you find yourself not having learned new things that would give you a better job, or perhaps even put you in a life you wanted. And if you're 30 and you walk away from a cult, you can still put it together and go to medical school or law school, whatever. I mean, you know, you do that for many, many years. If you're 60, probably not, you know? So the time that the cult eats oftentimes makes it so that when you leave, your economic dreams or your educational dreams are really something you can't do anymore. And that is something that cults do a lot. A local cult in America, well, actually it's in England too, International Church of Christ, they operate, you know about them. They operate around college campuses. There's one a couple of blocks from my church, and they routinely advise their members to drop out of college in order to full-time make disciples, which means run their Bible studies and infiltrate school cafeterias and libraries to snatch people. And so that's an educational diminishment. A friend of mine who got recruited by them in college was going to be an electrical engineer or something of the sort, and ended up dropping out because he wasn't devoting his life to Jesus by being an electrical engineer. So it kind of works that way.
I suppose in the sense of burning all of those bridges, and I'm going to use the word cultivating that environment where you are so segregated from everybody that you knew pre-cult, the amount of time and effort and energy that's gone into cultivating that environment could be so easily undone if you were to go to seminary and start learning other people's biblical interpretations of scripture, or if you were to go to medic school and realize that, oh, actually, I would rather spend my time saving more lives than learning this particular pastor's interpretation of the Bible. So I guess there is not just the time, the brain power, and the money that you give to the church, but also the consideration. It could be so easy for all of that to be undone if you were to hang out with worldly people, perhaps.
Be with the Philistines. Yeah. The thing is, when you make those decisions in the cult, I'm going to drop out of school or whatever. You make it with the vast majority of your thinking approving of dropping out of your education. You feel like you're doing the right thing, the best thing, because your emotional needs are being met right now. Why spend another $30,000 for an education that's not going to give you the things you're getting now in the cult? I believe there's a tiny little pea-sized part of you deep in your soul that is your soul, and that the cult simply never gets to. And that little part of you, when you do those decisions, kind of goes, and you tell that thing, oh, shut up. You don't understand. It's going to be really good. You know, someday you're going to be a group leader or something like that. But the overwhelming feeling that you have in the cult when you make that decision about your education or your money is that you're doing the right thing. It may hurt, but it's an investment that's worth being made, because those emotional needs that you have are right there at the door waiting for you if you just make that decision.
Then the next subheading on my list is parenting wounds.
Yeah. Parenting wounds. Of course, the greatest relationship that exists within the cult that is the most troubling to the cult leaders is the bonds between parents and children, particularly mothers and their children. I've read studies that are in fascinating studies that have mentioned, and these aren't Christian groups, but in some political cults and pretty rough stuff. It's when a mother truly realizes that her children are endangered in and by a cult, that's when she's likely to walk out the door. So very, very strong minds. So in our group, it wasn't until the parents started realizing the horrible effect this was having on children. And subsequently, we learned our children had been molested by the pastor, along with other children. But even before that, it wasn't until we realized the break in relationship between us and our children that we wanted and that we didn't have, and that was fostered and smiled upon by the cult, that we just realized our inner family life was empty within the cult. There was no closeness, and there was a lot of damage being done. So the parenting wounds are that when you leave a group like this, a cult, then your child oftentimes isn't ready to leave the cult. And they certainly aren't liable for the character and the personalities developed in the cult, because they were survival personalities that helped them make it in the cult. And so when you leave the cult and then you suddenly say, oh, you know, by the way, we're not going to do this anymore. This was wrong. You know, you're not going to lie about these things. We realized that was happening, but that was wrong. It's not like children can just handle a sudden shift in home and be okay with it, because they didn't choose who they are in the first place. They were born into this thing and raised in it. So you as a parent begin to see in perhaps no other more, you know, clear and humbling way the damage that the cult has done to your children. And it's a terrible, terrible thing to see that your child was afraid when you didn't think they were. And that your child was forced to repeat Bible verses and perspectives that they didn't believe and they didn't know. I mean, when my three-year-old is quoting the Bible, for God so loves the world that he gave his only begotten son, these beautiful words with rich significance. How is that three-year-old to understand what the heck that means? So when you begin to understand that you have raised your child in an inappropriate environment, expecting more mature behaviors and perspectives out of your child than they really are able to have, you feel terrible because you've lost those years. My daughters were, our youngest was a year and a half, and my middle girl was 10, and my oldest was 12, and they had been raised in a cult. Not so much my youngest, but my two older girls. And we couldn't get those years back from them. And so the parenting wounds are that you realize, I think what it, I only speak for myself here. I realized that I had given over responsibilities that I had as a father and that Sharon had as a mother. I had ceded those to cult leaders by following their teachings, by allowing their involvement and criticism over my parenting practices. And I had traded something away to become like a child myself in the cult that as a man, as an adult, I should have embraced, you know. And I love it with the young families in my church now that, oh no, it's very clear who the boss is. This is dad, this is mom, and no, Pastor Ken's not going to butt his nose in their life. This is them, and I respect it. And so when you realize leaving a cult that you sold that for a bowl of soup, you sold it for cheap, and that it damaged little people that you love very much, it's a devastating thing as a parent to realize that.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Infantilizing of adult members in coercive groups, again, is something that is a hallmark of coercive, which we hear about quite a lot on the show. Yeah. And the thing that you mentioned about handing over the responsibilities that you had as a father, the amount of introspection and deconstruction and healing and recovery must have had to go through to be able to openly discuss those things and take responsibility for those things, I think is quite telling of the person that you are and the experiences that you've been through. I think it takes a brave person to be able to come on somebody else's podcast and openly express those things. So I do appreciate you sharing that with me. Would you say that it's fair to assume then that with this next subheading of marriage wounds, some of the responsibility that you had as a husband, you also weigh to leadership in the church as well?
Absolutely. I don't believe the church at any time treated Sharon as a spouse or, you know, and sought to meet those needs. I wouldn't say that that was church policy at all. It's just that I tolerated viewing her as a fellow disciple, first off. So I didn't allow for the personal and intimate secret life that every husband and wife, should share with one another. And once we, in a sense, objectified each other, and I'll only speak for myself, as I objectified that in her, it became a lot easier to blame her for my own struggles in life, my own problems and whatnot. And I suppose she would mention her own struggles on that too. But our marriage really hit the rocks. It was marked by a lot of fighting, infidelity, and betrayal of each other personally within the cult. And basically, we would lay in bed at night, and it was like we were sleeping next to a stranger. And as I said, this is somebody that I knew when she was 15 and she knew me when I was 17. So we had a history with each other, which was had a very powerful place in our marriage. But we went through such a terrible time of disdain and loathing for one another in the cult that the marriage wounds, when you walk out of a group like that, really come down to a need to get back to the pre-cult marriage question of, do we want to continue to invest ourselves in a marriage? And do you still love me? And can you still love me? And do I still love you? And you know, those questions. And by the time we left, of course, we answered with a resounding yes, that I'm nuts about my wife, and she's, I hope, tolerant of me. but that decision had to be made. And sometimes in leaving a cult, the marriage is irreparably harmed. Sometimes marriages that happen within the cult don't have much of a chance when they leave the cult, because the only person you've ever known is the cult person. And once you leave and the cult person sheds itself from the soul of the person, people just realize, we're not right, and this isn't going to work. And I don't care what anybody says, it's not going to work. And they split up. And I accept that. I've seen it as a pastor. But that was the basic level of decision. Now, in terms of the betrayals in the marriage, I won't go into a big thing about all that. Nobody really wants to hear how 60-year-olds screwed up their life 30 or 40 years ago. But when we left, my feelings about Sharon, and I think her feelings about me, they were like this. Let's just say we had been in an internment camp and we had suffered gravely and terribly. And we had probably, we don't know how, but we stayed alive when many, 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 many others didn't make it. And many other marriages didn't make it. And then we get out and we're together again. We haven't seen each other for years. And it's like I'm looking in the face of somebody that I used to know. And I'm I love her. And she's had a rough time and I've had a rough time. Okay. I'm not going to, put my hands on her shoulders and say, well, what did you do to stay alive? Of course not. I'm going to say, thank God you're alive too. Let's get out of here. So that's kind of how it worked for this guy. Yeah.
I love that so much. That's like a really beautiful way of summarizing that whole thing. I suppose a lot of the time,
I kind of feel like I could cry right now.
Yeah, you know? I love that. That's really, it really is beautiful. I think it's unfortunate when you think about the other side of that, where people are so deeply damaged by their experiences that they aren't able to keep their hands off the shoulders and say, you need to tell me everything that happened in the fog, so to speak. And the almost trauma bonding experience mentioned as well of people meeting in the cult and marrying in the cult, either because they think it's a good idea or because leadership suggests that it's the right thing, or however those environments might play out. But then we do hear the occasional story of people meeting in these environments
and
still being together and still being wildly in love. Yes. I've heard even stories of former Unification Church members who were matched by some young moon who happened to actually genuinely fall in love with each other. So I think that, you know, that it gives me goosebumps to think about, you know, there are some situations where it's not all bad. And I think it was Pat Ryan who told me that it's really important to understand that not 100% of the takeaway of a cultic experience will be bad. And that was kind of like an epiphany for me. I was like,
Yeah. You're absolutely right, Pat. And Pat, yeah, you're absolutely right in that. And when I kind of first got into this cult recovery thing of just a few years ago, I was dead set on the idea that if you met in the cult, it's likely your marriage is going to not make it. And I even met with a pastor about a group that he was helping, full of fifth and sixth generation cultists. Wow. Who had, of course, met in the cult, and now they were leaving the cult. And I didn't give him any hope at all. I kind of said, well, I think you should expect a lot of marital problems and all that. And I was wrong about that, and proven wrong as I observed them in their recovery process. And that's a perspective that I absolutely have changed in. And I don't do that anymore because I just didn't think about it or whatever, but I grossly underestimated the power of two people just deciding to keep a loving commitment to each other, regardless of where they come from or where they met or what they brought into it. And that is so uniquely powerful that I've kind of been reconverted to love in that. I believe in that now, and I don't go there anymore. It's tough if you met in the cult, but if you both say, you know what, you aren't the person that I met in the cult now, and I'm not the person you met in the cult now, but you know what, I really want to make a go of this. Let's stick together. Wow, power. So
really powerful.
Yeah.
And after looking at some of these subheadings, there were some things that were listed in the chapter that might manifest in an individual as a result of experiencing these different wounds or types of abuse, either one or all, or a combination of wounds. And some of the things listed included guilt, depression, shame, self-medication, which you alluded to at the start of the episode when you're wandering your childhood street chain smoking. Is this something that you think you would easily be able to recognize now, when somebody might be suffering from spiritual abuse? Or are these still things that, because spiritual abuse is invisible, isn't it? We can't see those physical wounds because they're not physical wounds. Do you think now, as somebody that's it, you'd be able to identify somebody that might be going through those things, or is it still just as invisible as it's always been?
Yeah, I think depending on how much exposure I have to a person, I might be able to identify them. you know, one younger man, I met with him and I could just tell he was stressed beyond stress. He'd recently left his cult. And I said, how much are you sleeping? And he said, well, you know, a couple hours here and there. And I said, how much are you drinking? And he said, well, I'm putting away about this a fifth or whatever, you know, this much a night before I go to bed, or probably throughout the day. But so sometimes I am allowed in personally enough that it is appropriate for me to ask those questions. Other forms of self-medication, and by the way, cigarettes were nothing to me. I was a cocaine guy. Okay. So let's just be clear. Smoking a cigarette to me, life would be very good if I just would have stopped there and quit later, but I had a lot of other things. So the self-medication, so many of them are deeply, deeply personal, shame-inducing in themselves. So you're probably not going to meet with Pastor Ken over a cup of coffee and spill your guts to him, nor would I feel you should. I mainly just wanted to identify that we often find substances, or we often find activities and substances to give us the substance we want called dopamine. So if you get it from alcohol or pornography or fast drugs or slow drugs or day trading in the stock market, you know, whatever gives it to you, whatever gives you that little click, you may be struggling with medicating your way through the trauma of leaving a cult. And that sometimes I'm led into that discussion. But oftentimes, I strongly feel that a person who's left a group like that, even if they feel great, should get a checkup from their doctor and have a conversations and let the doctor know. And I mean, it's between them and their doctor, but you know, taking care of that physical part of you is very important. And sometimes that's the first self-affirming thing you do is, you know, geez, get some help. Get a sleep aid, get on an antidepressant or whatever, you know, whatever your doctor and you work out, but don't be afraid to start seeking the help you should have.
When you were talking earlier about getting the emotional support or the emotional feedback from the group, that I was thinking dopamine hits and the way that the brain becomes almost unable to function without it, and you know the dependence on the leader grows, the group and the community grows because of that environment. And of course, when things become so malignant inside the community that you're in, where all the leaders are living together, and things kind of go downhill pretty quickly, the emotional feedback is probably just becoming less and less and less. So you're out like, yes. How else can I fulfill part of myself? So I suppose in that way, not only is it a coping mechanism for perhaps trying to block out these thoughts of what am I doing? Why am I here? What about my family? What about my job and all of those things? Even if it's not that, or not a way to block out physical abuse or psychological abuse, but also for you to kind of keep your body getting those things that it's been craving, that it's been programmed to need in order to function for a very long time. Which is just me kind of rambling on thinking about things that are being said as we go.
You're absolutely right on with it. When you first are in the group, you're getting love bombed. And you don't, I mean, you see some amazing stories of, wow, I used to use heroin. Guess what? No more. I used to smoke a pack a day. No more. I drank. I did this. I did that. I had this. I would sleep around. I would do all these things. No more. And you would say, Jesus saved me. I'm good now. And really
package that up into like a newsletter or some type of propaganda that you can distribute on the streets.
I mean, wow, look at how powerful we are. We help people overcome these things. Well, when you're being love bombed, you do get your dopamine from that experience of unconditional love and everything. when that fails and it becomes training time, you have a new structure that keeps you in the cage, you're in the group, and yet you're not getting your dopamine love bombing fix. So then infatuation with other members, clandestine use of alcohol, drugs, relapses into various areas, all of that, they kind of come back as ways to self-medicate yourself through as a cult member.
That is the end of part two of this mini-series on surviving spiritual abuse. In the third and final segment, we will be looking at Ken's escape, recovery, activism, and holding on to faith. For a link to Ken's work, please follow the link in the episode description. To get in touch with me, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, host of the Cult Vault Podcast.